House Transportation Committee to order. President Representative Salmon, Dugan, Keller, Fairclough, and Vice Chair Newman. Representative Dahl is in the audience. If you'd like to come up and join the committee, we'd like to have you. We have a seat right here for you. Just for the folks in the audience, first we have Jeff Otteson is going to present until 2:30 on the STIP.
We have a chair right there.
At 2:30, we'll have Commissioner for Marine Operations come up, and the topic will be Marine Highway Scheduling. And at the very end, we're going to try and squeeze in. We have some representatives from Penwar that are going to come and talk about what's called the NORPASS. So we've got quite a schedule today. Mr. Otteson, before we start, any questions from the committee before we begin? Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, did we, I know I reviewed an accumulation of questions from our previous meeting, and I was wondering whether those had been generated to the department.
Those were forwarded, David. What time were those sent off, the questions?
About 2:30 yesterday.
Those were sent off to the commissioner's office at 2:30 yesterday, so hopefully we can get some answers back pretty quick. Thank you.
We don't have them.
We don't have the answers yet. They're good, but they're not quite
that good.
Yeah. And anybody in the audience, if we have cell phones, Blackberries, PDAs, we'd like you to keep those in your pockets with the ringers off. Thank you. Mr. Otteson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Otteson. I'm the Director of Program Development for the Department of Transportation. And in that capacity, I'm responsible for managing and producing the STIP. It's always good to be here before House Transportation. I know this is a topic of great interest, and my challenge in preparing the presentation was how much detail to get into. I prepared 40 slides. It could have been 100 slides. So if I have not hit the right degree of detail that you like, we'll be happy to expand it. And I hope I haven't gone too deeply into the detail, because as you'll see, it's a pretty complex subject matter.
Yeah, Mr. Otteson, just before you begin, I think some of the frustration with at least my constituents and folks across the state that I've been sent emails and phone calls to is the complexity, and it's obviously very complex. You're dealing with federal rules that you have to adjust to on the fly. That is one of the main frustrations, is not understanding exactly what's happened in the last couple of years. And we had a conversation in my office right about the changing federal regulations. So it will get very technical and detailed, and we hope you'll be as less specific as possible. I know it's difficult because you have a wealth of information.
It is, and there's a whole vernacular, there's a whole jargon that goes along with it that we use all the time and will be somewhat new to the listener. I think the one overarching comment I have to say is it is a technical program, and starting in about 2004, and you'll see this in my slides, the stability of this program, I really think, took a turn for the worst, and if anything, it's only accelerated. There's just lots of changes that have occurred at the national level. We as managers of the STIP are reacting, and I can appreciate why communities and users of this transportation system are so frustrated, because we're frustrated as well. There's not a lot we can do about that. You're going to see this is coming to us from on high. But I took the four topics that were outlined in an email to us back in December about what this presentation on slide number two there on the bottom of page one. I won't reread that, but we're generally talking about the STIP, SHAC-WAC, how the funding process works and relates to state budgeting, and then finally the production of the STIP and amendments for the STIP.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Otteson, could you explain SHAC-WAC?
I have slides on that topic, but in a nutshell, SHAC-WAC is a term that's used for two different funding programs. One is a long-standing program to build parts of the highway system in Yukon Territory, in a very small piece of British Columbia, that has been funded with federal highway dollars, that is U.S. federal highway dollars, for over 30 years. The second use of the term is for a more recent provision in law that allowed us to to create a special category of funding that was at one time eligible for the Marine Highway System and the Haynes Highway, and then more recently was eligible for those two things, plus roads that lead to ferry terminals. And I'll talk about all that in more detail later on.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so that I understand this, basically the STIP is required as a means of accessing federal money?
That is correct, Representative Dugan, through the chair. It is essentially a legal requirement that the state must follow before a single dollar, those federal dollars, is eligible to us. So we have to. That's the club held over our head. So if I can get into it, at the bottom of page 2, this federal highway program that we operate within, that we receive funding from, has been around a very long time, more than 90 years, going back to 1916. It's a very large and unwieldy body of law. It's been amended many, many times over those 90-some years. It had the last amendment, the Safety Lou Act, passed in 2005, was 1,700 pages. It, just to give you some idea of how just how large the amendment was. You just don't see bills that large in this building, but that's how large Safety Lou was. It, as a consequence of all these amendments and all these chances for it to be dealt with, it has been tinkered with and exceptions abound. We tell our own staff as they begin to learn the system, we will talk in general rules. Things are done this way, but there's almost always an exception to a general rule. And so it's very frustrating. You have so many exceptions to the general rules. At the same time, you have to know the general rules. As a consequence of that complexity, it's hard to find subject matter experts. I've been at this, dealing with the STIP and dealing with these rules now for 12 years. I still learn things. I'm still finding new nuances to it that I haven't known before. And it's very hard to find staff who want to take the time to learn it. Many people work at DOT, but very few people have to deal with this arcane body of knowledge. And I hate to say this, but the state just lost their expert to retirement. Carol Taylor left last fall, and the Federal Highway Division office here in Juneau lost one of their experts, Karen Tennyson, also retired. So just in a few months now, we've lost probably the two most knowledgeable people in the state of Alaska have gone to retirement. The process, in that body of law, they set out a transportation planning process. This is a process that's essentially required for the state to access these funds. It's codified in the United States Code in sections 134 and 135. It's also codified in regulations. And it applies to all the federal highway funds we receive. It also applies to the federal transit funds, which is kind of the hidden part of the program, but it's been a growing part of our program. The transit funding has gone up more rapidly than is highway funding in the past few years. It's interesting to note that the mandate that there be a planning process has been in federal law going back to 1934, so it's not new. What's new is that it's gotten more complex and more demanding, that more process rules have been added to the planning process. But it essentially calls for the state to produce two documents, a long-range transportation plan and a short-range spending plan for how we intend to spend our federal dollars in accordance with that longer-range plan. In addition to those two documents, there are several sort of related documents or requirements. We are required to produce data on any number of items: the condition of the roadway system, the condition of bridges, condition of our pavements, inventory of those roads, how wide they are, their functional classification, whether they're a local road or an arterial, those types of terms. In fact, if you talk to federal highways, they will tell you that data is our first duty. Don't do the data and you won't get the money. So it's just one of those things. We have a fairly large number of staff that are involved in producing these data sets and delivering them annually to the Federal Highway Administration. And these get added up and produced in documents and produce national reports about the condition of the system. It's one of the requirements. In addition to that data, we have a public outreach process. We have topics of consideration that we must take into account. We have requirements for consultation with other federal, state, local, and tribal agencies. And as we produce, particularly the STIP, more so than the plan, we have to do so in strict fiscal discipline. You'll hear more about that. The fiscal discipline is one of the new requirements where we're not allowed to put on the rose-colored glasses as we write the STIP. We have to be very hard, look forward in the future, and try to best guess how much federal funding we're getting. They also split the duties. The State Highway Agency, which is the term they use in the Act itself, so each state Department of Transportation or Department of Highways or whatever it's called, is responsible for many of the duties. But these duties are shared with the large metropolitan areas in each state, what are known as MPOs or Metropolitan Planning Organizations. Alaska has two communities that are eligible for this status, the Fairbanks, Greater Fairbanks area, including the North Star Borough and the City of North Pole and the City of Fairbanks, and in Anchorage, the municipality of Anchorage. So they have responsibilities too. They're required to produce their own plans and to produce their own spending plans, or TIPs as they're called, transportation improvement programs. And so in those two geographic areas, the decision making is really being held by those metropolitan organizations and not by the state or the state DOT or any state level organization. It's an important thing to understand because it's almost like a separate entity within the larger state of Alaska.
Representative Fairclough.
How soon do we expect MATSU to come on with the appropriate density and population numbers?
I would not be surprised to see them reach it in the 2010 census, and it takes about 2 years for all that to get documented and turned into a mandate that they become an MPO. So that would roughly 2012 would be my best guess.
So just for the committee's clarification, it takes two components to reach an MPO status. One is density of 50,000, as I recall, and one is density per mile. So you have to have it incorporated. Can you tell me what percentage of the dollars that are coming into the feds are currently going to MPOs and how that will be impacted by the addition of MATSU?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, this is one of those places where there's an exception in law. In all other states except Hawaii and Alaska, there is a formula in law that determines how much money goes to an MPO. You take one of the categories of money we get, and then I think the percentage is 62% of it. You look at 62% of that amount of money, and then you just take a strict population proportion. So if the MPO is 10% of your state population, the MPO would get 10% of 62%, or a little more than 6% of that one category of money. In Alaska, we were left out of that formula. No alternate formula was provided, so we are sort of on our own to develop it. We developed that in regulations in 2002, and that formula delivers to the two MPOs approximately twice as much as the federal formula would have delivered had we been under the federal formula. So to get to your question, what it would do is take the money that is now going to all of the non-MPO parts of the state, everybody but Fairbanks and Anchorage, and a sliver of that would be set aside for MATSU. That's sort of the effect of it. What that sliver would be based upon the state formula, which is quite a bit more complex than the federal formula. It takes into account population, number of miles of road, the safety record on those roads, and some other factors. So.
Thank you.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So. Is what you're saying that the parts of the STIP that have to do with the municipality of Anchorage actually come out of the AMATS process rather than out of any state process? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, yes, that's correct, with the exception that a few categories of funding that are spent within Anchorage still come out of the state process. The National Highway System routes we do in cooperation with each other. They certainly can identify their routes, but we get to decide sort of how fast the funding flows to them against all their needs in the state. And then some of the categories like safety and bridge funding still remain under the state discretion. But the bread and butter portion of their program is decided by the AMATS policy board, and the state's job is essentially to approve that as written. We do not have any veto power over that plan.
And if I might, and this is just the construction part of this.
Well, it's The dollars can be used for construction, they could be used for buying buses, they could be used for even doing some operational thing. So I don't want to characterize it as just construction. They could even use those dollars for planning. So it's whatever they choose to put those dollars to would be their decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
So at the bottom of page 3, these two documents, the first is the statewide transportation plan that I understand was talked about last week.
And Jeff, before you go on, we have scheduled, as you well know, a hearing specifically on this 2030 plan, so take that into account.
Okay, so all I'll do is talk high level. I won't talk about the details of the plan itself, just the requirements. It's to be statewide in scope. It's to have a 20-year horizon. These are all written in federal law now. It's to be multimodal. It's to look at all the modes. There are specific factors we're to consider and analyze, and those factors are set out in the plan. So if you see a copy of the plan, it's on page 3. And it's to be prepared in consultation with several different organizations. And you see the list there. But it's essentially both public and private organizations who have an interest in transportation. Probably more important for our state is how do you go about producing this plan? You know, if you look around the country and you see how other states do it, there's essentially two approaches. Some states do it, you know, one plan does it all. They just produce this long-range transportation plan, and it is their department plan, their state plan for transportation. It tends to be states with fairly simple systems. They don't have a lot of other modes to consider. And even the modes they do have tend to be very high-level roads, the interstates and the highest-level arterials. For example, in Georgia, only 10% of their road system is owned by the state. The other 90% is not owned by the state, so they're only focusing on a small subset of the highways. Alaska's not in that kind of state situation. We're a state where we own 40% of the road network. But more importantly, we have ferries, we have aviation, we have an interest in ports and harbors, we have a complex transportation system. We also have big geography, and with big geography, you have big variations and big differences. I can't imagine trying to write a one-plan-fits-all approach in our state, even though we're a small population. We're anything but small in terms of how you develop this transportation system. And about a third of the states have chosen to treat the overall plan as a policy plan, a strategic vision plan, but not try to put lines on the map, not try to select projects. That's been our approach since this requirement came online shortly after 1993, and I believe it's still the best approach for our state. And now, in state law, we've actually codified this concept of a tiered plan where you have an overarching plan and then you have more detailed plans. And I would venture to say, I've never really counted it up, but we have at least 15 or 20 different subordinate plans that are on our bookshelf that help flesh out what the long-range plan is trying to say. So we have plans for aviation. We have plans for marine highway. We have plans for systems corridors or regions, Southwest, Prince William Sound, Southeast, etc. We have plans for the Parks Highway Corridor. We have plans for the use of ITS technology, etc., etc. We have a lot of different documents that then feed up and serve to flesh out the details of the long-range plan. So understand that we've chosen to keep the long-range plan in Alaska high level and let the subordinate plans do the talking of details, project selection, project identification.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, you talked about some of the subordinate plans. Where do we find more information on them, say like the Parks Highway Plan?
Well, Representative Newman, and through the chair, these plans are all found on our website and under our planning link, and I'd be happy to provide that here after the meeting. But these plans are all kept as PDF files where they can be downloaded and looked at. So at the bottom of page 4, the other document we produce, and I'm just going to talk about it kind of in the high level now. There's more detail deeper in the presentation, but is the STIP requirement. STIP stands for Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. It's a federal term. All 50 states have to produce one. And it has, by law now, a 4-year horizon. That's a change in safety lieu. It used to be 3 years. It is required to access federal funds. We have to have an approved STIP. It has to have gone through a certain process and been actually physically approved by two federal agencies. They will send a letter that they jointly sign and approve it before we can access federal funds. It, in theory and in practice, needs to be consistent with a long-range plan. In other words, you can't write a long-range plan that says X and then try to do projects under it in the STIP that are completely contrary to the long-range plan.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the State Transportation Improvement Plan, who approves it at a state level? Is it just the administration in conjunction with the governor?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, it is that duty is delegated to the commissioner. The commissioner sends it forward to the two federal agencies and asks for their approval. So his signature is found in the document, usually in a transmittal letter to the public.
Is that a federal requirement that it stays internal with the administration, or is there a legislative process in other states?
That's a good question. Other states use different techniques. There's a handful of states where the STIP is approved by the legislature. In the majority of states, that's not true. It's done by the executive branch. The law itself, the federal law, speaks to the state highway agency in a kind of in lower case, referring to now what is known as state DOTs in most states.
So under MPOs, do we have any state regulations that impose their passing their transportation plans through their local assemblies, or do we mandate that for them?
We do not mandate that in the state regulation. Each MPO sort of follows its own process. If you look around the nation, the MPOs are remarkably diverse and complex, and I was talking to MPO leaders last week that, you know, there's 80 local governments, crosses state boundaries, involves two state legislatures, two governors. So that's kind of the one end of the spectrum of complexity. In our state, our MPOs are relatively simple by comparison. So
thank you.
The STIP is required to identify the scope, the extent, or where the physical boundaries, the schedule, and the cost, and the funding types of all the projects you propose to accomplish. It's to be federally reviewed and approved, as I've mentioned. And this is where the fiscal constraint requirement has always been there, but it's kind of come at us now with more vigor. It's to be fiscally constrained not only by year, but by phase of work. We use the term phase to refer to the design and environmental work as one phase, right-of-way work as another phase, moving utilities is a third category of phase, construction is a fourth. So all of these things have to be shown, and they all have to add up to a maximum number of dollars that we believe is available. We, even as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, the STIP was being over-programmed. We were often showing more projects than was realistic for the funding. There's a reason to do that if you think about it. But more importantly, we never could deliver those projects. Not only did the cost go up, the STIP was really unrealistic on the day it was printed. We're not allowed to do that now. We have to write a STIP that is very, very strict to our estimate of dollars. And as I'll show you later in the presentation, our estimate of dollars is going to become very difficult because of all the uncertainty that's now clouding the crystal ball.
Representative Salmon.
The question I have is, I know you apply this to the airports and the rural communities. How do you apply the same rule to the rural roads and the smaller communities?
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, We going back to about 1995, we started creating criteria that were really meant for rural communities and have allowed them to compete kind of on equal footing with urban communities. Now, I should back up and tell you that one of the exceptions in our law is that rural roads are eligible for our STIP dollars here in Alaska. That is one of the exceptions in law that applies to only Puerto Rico and Alaska. In any other state, that wouldn't be true. But once we had that exception, we have made rural communities. We've been working in particular. If you look at the criteria have been focused on achieving sanitation roads, roads to landfill sites and water sites and sewage lagoons, that sort of thing, getting people to a basic level of sanitation.
Representative
That's been the state's focus, and that has been true for about a dozen years now.
Jeff, is this one of the areas where some of the public frustration has come in with the changing of what actually appears in a STIP document? We used to get it and have years and years, I can't remember how many, six or five. Well, there were projects that were funded and not funded. Could you elaborate on how that change has affected the public's perception of projects?
We have, over the years, changed the number of years shown. The STIP in the past was a three-year document. We used to try to program three more years to show people what was coming, to give them a sense of, yeah, they're in the plan, you know, your day is not too far off in the future. We've gone back and forth about the value of that. In an era where the costs seem to always go up and the money seems to go down, you end up changing people's date so many times, pushing them farther and out in the future, that feels like a sort of a hollow promise. So we have vacillated. We have vacillated between showing just the minimum number of years necessary, as opposed to being more more predictive of the future. And I think when you see the right now what's going on in the next few years with funding, right now my tendency would be to stick to the four-year prediction. We're having a hard enough time living and predicting accurately 4 years. Anything beyond that is the crystal ball just doesn't have a good answer. So the bottom of page 5, these federal rules have grown more complex and demanding. There are now about 20 different funding types that we have to take into account when we write the STIP. We don't write the STIP with a single flavor of money and just, you know, it's not like general funds where there's just one category fits all. It's the money comes to us in many different categories. In some cases, these categories are further divided into subcategories. And as I've already said, lots of rules and then exceptions to rules that make knowing how to write the STIP, knowing what's eligible, a struggle sometimes. What has added to it is new regulations were enacted in early 2007. These regulations are a result of Safety Lou. They were first public noticed as draft regulations in the summer of 2006. And to give you some idea, between then and the time that they came out to the public comment period closed, I worked on two of three AASHTO committees that responded to these regulations. That resulted in a 50-page letter produced by AASHTO of concerns and worries about the regulations, what they meant for the states. We also authored our own state-level 10-page letter that did nothing but talk about things that the AASHTO letter had not already covered. So we didn't repeat anything AASHTO had said. So and other states did the same thing. So you can tell there was a lot of concern. States were very worried about these regulations. They were afraid they were going to impact their ability to conduct business. And I can tell you that that's been true. I got a new example of that just this morning. I was invited last week to speak before a committee to represent a state view to the federal agencies to tell them what these regulations are now doing for us, just the problems they're creating and the issues they've made, the difficulties they've applied to our program. And it was very interesting. The federal officials at the national level seemed to say, well, you know, we really didn't meant for this to be so complex or so difficult. You just need to work through your local agencies, the Division Office of Fed Highways or the Seattle Office of FTA. But the reality is that there are different interpretations, and if you just read the plain words, you kind of come to worry about them, because the words are pretty demanding, and the flexibility is somewhere in between those words, because it's not in the words themselves. And so all I'm trying to say is these regulations have changed our way of doing business. You're going to come to think of the old STIP, 2007 and prior, is the good old days, and the new STIP, 2008 and forward, is the not so good old days. I hate to be the bearer of that tiding, but that's sort of the truth.
You're scaring me. Representative Faircloth.
I just want to expand for the record a description of what AASHTO is so that the public knows.
Yes, I'm sorry. AASHTO is the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. And it is an organization that essentially works on behalf of all 50 state DOTs before the federal agencies and Congress itself.
Jeff, you'd mentioned before the difficulties of dealing with all of the new regulations. You also mentioned in a meeting in my office about ways other states are dealing with these regulations, and can you elaborate, pre-funding or?
Well, as you'll see deeper into the presentation, one of the most difficult things we face now is the need to constantly amend the STIP whenever something changes in terms of either funding or cost. And that's going to create many problems. And some states have said, enough is enough. We're just going to forward fund our federal program. We're going to produce projects with state dollars under the federal rules, you know, with advance notice to the federal agency so the projects are eligible for federal reimbursement, and then they will just simply write a STIP that reimburses themselves against the known set of cost. You don't have to amend anything if the costs are already fixed and on the books and were expended in a prior year. The only way we could do that as a state would be to forward fund this program with about $300 to $400 million of general fund dollars. And so we'd have to have that funding source in advance to take advantage of that tool. But truthfully, it may come to that if we want to avoid the possibility of losing federal dollars, because as you'll see later in the presentation, that possibility is going to be ever present in the future.
Has that borne out to be successful in states who've tried that?
I believe it has, but see, these are states that already have substantial state-funded programs, so they are, you know, it wasn't so difficult for them to come up with the dollars. They've got a flow of cash that's coming in through a state gas tax or state registration fees, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you. When I served on AMATS, Jeff, I was under T21. And T21 didn't allow a reimbursement clause, at least for right-of-way acquisition. So in the new safety lieu, I know that when I served on AMATS locally in Anchorage, which is the Anchorage Metropolitan Planning Organization, when we served there, we submitted under the safety lieu rewrite a request for authorization to be able to pay back, basically, if we advance funded or bought right-of-way in the future that we knew that we were going to need for a project. So we're sure now that we can do a reimbursement?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, that's correct to a point. One of the struggles we still have with that concept is if the state or the municipality pre-purchases right away and then goes into a NEPA process and basically says, look, we have to build the road right here because we already bought the right away, that may be sort of pre-deciding and not letting NEPA come to the ultimate decision about where the road should be placed. So the risk is you can't kind of pre-determine the outcome of NEPA.
I understand, and just for the committee's edification is why I was bringing it up. When we talk about looking at $400 million to forward fund a transportation program, we need to recognize that we take risk in that if we submit for payback, basically, that because we haven't followed the continuum that the federal government uses, we may not qualify for as much reimbursement.
Right.
So,
to elaborate on that, buying right away on a road that already exists, where your goal is to widen it, would be a very low risk proposition.
Absolutely. I was thinking of a different corridor where
New corridors might be more complex.
Right. Can you tell me when safety lieu expires? What year?
Safety lieu expires in 21 months at the in September 30th of 2009.
The shifting ice that we're worried about for our polar bears continues to shift at a federal level. So my point with that is, just for clarity for the record, is that if the pieces are always moving, it's hard to forward fund a project and know what you're going to be reimbursed for.
Right. The bottom of page 5, the last point on this slide, is that there have been just more and more and ever more sort of surprising policy shifts coming out of Congress. One I'll talk about a lot later on is rescissions, and now the new wrinkle to rescissions is proportional rescissions. A rescission is essentially money that they take back. They promise you money, they award it, and then they take it back. Proportional rescissions mean you have to give it back in the same ratio that you received it. You can't have any flexibility in choosing between the categories of money. And you'll see later on that ties our hands and gives us forces us to spend projects or to build projects that may not be the state's highest priority, but they are the highest priority that fit that particular category of money. The other thing they've been doing is mandating ever more things we have to do to use the money. And a lot of these mandates have come with no new funding. So some examples, in 2009, there's a mandate that we deliver real-time data to the public about weather and traffic. New mandate, really no new money to help make that happen. It's just a new requirement placed on the state. We are also now required to talk to wildlife agencies, agencies that manage wildlife, about mitigation and crossings and that sort of thing. And if you talk to those agencies, they want bridges that cost, you know, tens of millions of dollars to allow these wildlife to cross. So we've got new costs being mandated, but no new money. You know, I'm not going to speak to the pro or con of any of these ideas, but when you add new mandates and you don't add new money, then we ultimately achieve less with the dollars that are left. One they just added just this past fall was the notion of complete streets. Complete streets is a philosophy that when you build a road, you will provide for pedestrians, bicyclists, and transit users in all cases, so that you will basically never forget those modes as well. So those are some examples of mandates that have been coming at us that have been unfunded.
Representative Fairclough?
On that mandate, is there exception in on rural roads and trails, or is it defined by the class of road, the actual amenities that have to be provided?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, no details yet coming. What we've got essentially was a sense of Congress inserted into the energy bill. So it'll take a while for this to trickle into regulation or policy.
So for Alaska, that could have dire consequences if we're building a goat trail somewhere just to provide a snow machine access corridor or a four-wheeler corridor that I've seen. If we have to provide a bike trail along with a sidewalk, that could be draconian for our projects. Thank you.
Yeah, you would hope that common sense would prevail, but I've become a little bit jaundiced about common sense sometimes in working in this program. So,
Jeff, what happens to the rescissions? Do they go back to the general fund? Are they redistributed to DOT, or what happens?
Well, the rescissions thus far have been taking and I'll get into the details of this, they've been taking essentially the non-cash part of what they give us. But it has a consequence, even though it doesn't necessarily take away a dollar. And I'll explain that later, a little later on.
Okay.
And I'll also explain why it's happening. At the top of page 6, these new federal STIP rules that we talked about, these are the first changes to the STIP regulations since 1993. So it's been about a 13-year period without changes. I talked a little bit about the process of the state participating in response to the regs, the two letters that were written. But it's important to note that the attorney for AASHTO that was helping us write this letter, he made it very clear that most of the regulation changes that were enacted weren't at the discretion of Federal Highway Administration or Federal Transit Administration, but in fact were firmly written in the law itself. In other words, the regulations were basically had already been preordained in the law. So they weren't using any editorial license to speak of. They were sort of reacting to what was already mandated in law. So Congress had mandated these changes, and the agencies were simply kind of putting a few details on decisions that were already firmly made. That makes it a little harder for them to give us any leeway when we asked for it. There was no leeway to give. One of the serious changes is the number of things that will trigger a STIP amendment. It just has gone way up. Amendment takes a minimum of 90 days to process, and that's if it's small and kind of everything goes quickly. And it can take, if I look at the last major amendment we did on the STIP in the summer of last summer, it took about 5 months, so it can be a lot longer than 90 days. Anything that changes the cost, the schedule, the scope, or the fund source of a project triggers an amendment. Let me think about that. Anything that changes a project. So the last thing we want to see now are changes to projects. And we have taken time, gone out to our three regions, talked to our engineers, both on the design side and in the construction side, and said, there's a consequence to an amendment. You don't want to go there. You don't want to ask for it. And I'll just give you one example. Let's say we're working on a major highway reconstruction and we run into unexpected geological conditions and there's a need for a large change order to pay the contractor. We need to get, let's say, $3 million additional into a project and it triggers a STIP amendment. We can't pay that $3 million until we get the STIP amended. And if it takes 5 months, we could have gone from July to December. Contractor's now shut down. He's got consequential damages because we've delayed him. The STIP is potentially paying tens of millions of dollars to solve a problem that just shouldn't have happened. And in fact, this is one of the things that I mentioned last week in D.C. You know, a STIP amendment rule is great in Alabama where they have a 12-month construction season. It doesn't work in Alaska where the construction season is 5 months. So it's another one of the consequences. We're going to have to somehow have very sharp pencils, write very good estimates, and have no change conditions. But that's not the nature of construction. It's just history tells us these changes will pop up and we will have to deal with them when they do.
What? How does the canceling of a project by the chief executive of the state fit into the change definition that would make you do a STIP amendment? Or projects that are canceled, say, by the governor, is that illegally have an effect on the STIP? Where is that? Is there a process that has to go through, or would a proclamation of a project being canceled not necessarily legally fit into that category?
It really wouldn't fit into that category. You know,
does it have any bearing?
Use an example: if that project was being canceled and its dollars wanted to be used in another project, we would have to do a STIP amendment to show those dollars going elsewhere. So that couldn't occur without a STIP amendment. But if a project were simply canceled, you know, or delayed, I mean, it's the cancel and delayed are really sort of the same thing. We do have to do a STIP amendment, I guess, to delay it, to show that the schedule is changing. So
for example, obviously the Gravina Island Bridge. I did pretty good for about
I'm drawing a picture here.
You drew a picture of a bridge. So is that project still obviously the governor's comment that it's been canceled, is that is it really canceled, or I mean, can she do that?
There has been no STIP amendment, and that's because right now we are frozen. Our STIP is frozen until we finish our long-range transportation plan, and we could talk about that a little bit later. But the two documents are linked, and that's one of the reasons we're rushing to finish the long-range plan, is that we're not going to be able to spend our 2008 money or make a STIP amendment until that first step is done.
Representative Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarity, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but was the Gravina Bridge ever in the STIP because it was a federal earmark?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, yes. The earmarks have to be shown in the STIP. It was in the STIP for its different phases. And I'd have to go back and look. I don't know if we had it. Since we were lacking full funding, we had not shown it in the 08 or 09 construction year.
It was just in there, but it was in the out year.
Well, it had been in earlier phases when we started design and right-of-way steps. But we hadn't yet programmed in a current STIP. We hadn't programmed a construction phase because under the rules, we have to have the funding identified.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the STIP requires you to not just show what project you're funding, but to show it in the construction phases and, I guess, by year, then if we were going, let's take a hypothetical multi-year construction project, like, say, the Gravina Island Bridge, just as an example. And you put the first phase of that, or the first year of that, and it's not clear to me which one of those you would put in, into the STIP that year, what assurance would you have that you'd be able to get the second or the third phase of that approved? You see what I'm asking you? If we're only doing it 1 year at a time, if we're doing these projects, these big projects, which are going to extend over more than one STIP, 1 year at a time, how do you know you're going to get the money for it in year three?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, you ask a very good question, and I'll talk a little bit later about how the funding comes and what the federal scheme to kind of give you the ability to see forward a little bit better than just 1 year at a time. But bottom line is, once the state starts down the road on doing a project, if it fails to complete the project, it owes those funds back to the federal purse. So we, as a state, on all projects that we start, have to have the conviction of going forward to the end, or we will have to find state dollars to repay the federal funds expended to date.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then that would mean that any multi-year project that just found itself in any kind of significant cost increase, if there's also a limit on the amount of money that you're going to get from the federal government, could put you in the position where either you're going to have to spend a lot of state dollars to complete it, or you're going to have to pay back the first parts of that. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. And there's one other tool we're required to use on these large projects, the projects larger than $100 million. And we're required to do a financial plan that shows how it's to be funded over time. We're required to also escalate it to the year of construction. In other words, to use an inflation factor to the year of construction over those multiple years. So, and then we're required to update that annually. So there was one of these financial plans prepared for Gravina, and what it essentially showed is that we needed a great many state dollars to supplement the federal dollars that had been allocated to it at that time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before we go on, recognize the minority leader, Representative Krutula is in the room. Representative Newman and then Faircloth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the immediate conversation. I think Representative Faircloth has a question germane to this. Is it a different question?
I'll yield to Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Ms. Lowell.
I just wanted to clarify, there is one other alternative, and that is after you go through a planning process, there can be a decision rendered of no build. So if you're going through a planning process, is that correct? Then we don't have to repay.
Through the chairman, Representative Faircloth, it's actually the NEPA process, and if you select the no-build alternative at that time, at the end of NEPA, you are exempt from that repayment responsibility. The problem is, in most projects, I mean, I've only seen one no-build in my career, so it's not a common event.
Was there, we have a couple more questions, but just quickly, does it, obviously it matters where in the process, if a project has a record of decision and you're right there ready to go, as it goes through the different processes, does it have a different effect on canceling a project? I mean, Gravina was at record of decision and it was a go for a build waiting for funding. As you go through the process and jump through those triggers, does that have an effect on?
Well, once you've passed the record of decision, you know, lots of things happen to projects. Projects get delayed for other reasons. They may get strung out over more years. All that's allowed. None of that violates the fundamental decision to go forward. As long as you're making progress on a project in some way and showing good faith to complete it, it could take a very long time and you could still get it done. That wouldn't trigger the repayment clause. It's sort of when you just shut it down and said to sort of turn your back on a project and walk away. That's what triggers this repayment. And so, you know, we have just recently shut down some projects, and because we didn't want to get to the record of decision where we would have to then start paying money back, because we can now see that we're just not going to have funding to do those. So there have been, I can think of two or three projects that have recently been shut down to avoid repayment of federal funds.
But just for the record, the record of decision was reached on the Gravina project?
Record decision has not only been reached, we've also done work on the project in the form of the road work on Gravina Island and bought right away. So we're well past the record of decision.
Representative Newman and then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Addison, my understanding then, if there's any federal funds coming to a road project, if there's a change or something that happens along the way there, that would require an amendment, which would take up to 90 days.
Yeah, 90 days would be the minimum, and any number of things can trigger an amendment. There are some amendments that can occur with a simpler set of rules known as an administrative modification. But what's really happened is what fits inside that set of rules is sort of small, and what fits into the amendment trigger is grown larger.
So if that was kind of just a yes question.
Yes. Let me just give you one other example of where we've been kind of caught by this new requirement. We had a small city street project funded by Earmark in Nome, and near the time it was going out to bid, it was suddenly realized that we needed to do a small amount of utility work, move some fire hydrants, move some city utility poles. The amount of work was, I think, about $50,000, and it was over a $3 million project. So you're talking about something in the order of less than 2% of total cost. And that was going to trigger the need for an amendment, which at the time was, we would have had to then wait for the long-range plan to be done, which would have put it clear out into the, in the 08 summer. We would have lost an entire year. And basically what happened was the city of Nome, in their own defense, said, we'll pay for that work with city funds to avoid the need for the amendment. So we got around it, but we didn't get around it by, you know, by the common sense approach, other than community basically pitched in and spent $50,000 of their own money.
Follow up on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in as far as the, as long as we're talking bridges to everywhere, at the Kinnick Arm Bridge, so there's been federal money spent on that through an earmark and some state funds on that and other funds.
Correct.
So now we're getting up against a deadline for an RFP proposal to be submitted. So if we didn't make that, could that trigger an amendment? And if so, what type of, you'd also mentioned too that the state may be required to pay back the federal government if a project is not completed. Would that fall into that category?
Well, that project is not yet past the stage of a ROD, so it doesn't have a ROD yet. It just, I think, released the final environmental impact statement, which is out for public review. So public review is needed, and then there would be a ROD. And at that point, anything, you then are facing repavement if you don't go forward.
So ROD being a record?
The ROD, record of decision, which is the kind of the legal conclusion of the National Environmental Policy Act environmental process, NEPA, as it's called. So we're not quite at that threshold yet, but we're not too far away either.
So can you, where are we at? And can you
get, well, we, the as I understand it, the final EIS was just released in the past week or so.
Yeah.
So that has to be, goes out for public review, agency review, comments come in. The applicant will then work with Federal Highways, who is what's known as the lead agency, and the Federal Highways has, they have control of that decision on the ROD. They essentially, you know, the agency produces it, Kubota produces that document, but the decision is held by Federal Highway Administration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to take one more question from, or he may have multiple questions, from Representative Johnson, and then we're going to take a break for the Marine Highway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'd mentioned that we'd done some work on Gravina Island, back to your pet peeve.
The bridge to the future.
And that other access roads have been either built or constructed or planned. I'm assuming that was with some federal money. Do we have to pay that back?
The Representative Johnson, through the chair, the plan right now is we need to go back to the community, open up that environmental document, and look at a series of different alternatives, with the goal being that we will end up with an outcome that will avoid the state having to pay money back. That's essentially the plan right now.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Is there any plan that would not include building a bridge that would prevent us from having to pay that back?
One of the alternatives will be a ferry alternative coupled with these roads.
How much money are we talking about that we have on the line that we might have to pay back?
Ron, do you know offhand? About $55 million right now. If we don't successfully conclude this EIS in a way that avoids that outcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to take a 5-minute at ease to let the Marine Highway get ready. Thank you, Mr. Otteson, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, many members.
To order, we're going to go on with the director of the Marine Highway System, And again, we're going to try and get through this in enough time. I think the Penwar people are going to show up around 3 or 3:15, and they have a relevant presentation for about 10 or 15 minutes. We have invited Mr. Hardy, Mr. Falvey. I know you're the man with a lot of the answers, but we'd like to have Mr. Hardy at the witness table.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Can you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes. My name is Dennis Hardy. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Alaska Marine Highway System. I would like to recognize Captain John Falvey, who's with us today. He's the general manager of the system. Mr. Dick Leary, who is our business manager. Chuck Van Kirk, who is our chief of operations. And he's currently working on the schedule, which is a topic of discussion today. And Jim Beadle is with us also. He's currently a special assistant assigned to the commissioner's office. We did provide handouts to the committee, and those are for reference only. I expect that we'll be referring to those as we respond to questions, but we didn't intend to directly address that information. And I do have a prepared statement on the 08-09 summer schedule, if I may. On behalf of Marine Highways, I acknowledge that the schedule for summer 2008 is later than normal this year. It's currently our top priority, and we're continuing to put our full resources on it, and we will have it completed in time to be printed for the Milepost and several other publications. We're in close communication with these publications as we complete the work. The schedule will be available on our website and for booking by January 31st. Currently, our reservation staff is logging reservation requests. I recognize the impacts to the traveling public who rely on timely marine highway schedules so that they can make their travel plans. I also recognize the impacts on the travel support industry, travel agents, tour companies, hotels, and the like. Understand the importance of providing a reliable schedule that will not change as a result of funding issues. And I want to assure all of those folks that next year we intend to be back on our usual timetable and that this delay should be a one-time event. The schedule is late this year due to major changes in routes and the service that we're providing. I made the decision that all of the boats could not run all of the time on the same schedule as we had last year and the years before. Therefore, instead of preparing what I would call a cookie-cutter schedule similar to prior years, we basically had to create an entirely new base schedule. This is no easy task. It's extremely complex and time-consuming when you consider all the variables that enter into that work effort. There are two primary factors that entered into our decision to take this approach. And the first factor is fiscal responsibility for the system. We inherited a system that in FY07 saw a general fund increase of 18% to nearly $100 million a year. Operating costs were escalating dramatically, and we brought that into check. GF is roughly $89 million in the current governor's budget, and this is only slightly higher than the GF level in FY08, which was about $84 million. To bring fiscal responsibility to the system required some major changes to the schedule and operation of the vessels. Long-term sustainability of the system is a Marine Highways goal, and I also believe that the legislature wants Marine Highways run in a fiscally sound manner. Second factor I'd like to discuss is balancing the needs of Alaskans and the Alaskan economy. There's been an ongoing debate regarding whether Marine Highway should serve Alaskans only or whether we should serve tourists as well. I believe the proposed plan that we've developed presents an appropriate balance of both. We will remove the mainliner, Malaspina, from the Bellingham run where it ran at 50% to 75% capacity. And that resulted in inefficient expenditure of millions of dollars in operating costs. The Malaspina will now provide dayboat service in Lynn Canal, and this is where we believe improved service is needed. The Columbia will continue to provide service to Bellingham, and the traffic displaced from the Malaspina will increase the capacity utilization of the Columbia. The Columbia will continue to provide service to Bellingham. And we believe that the Columbia will provide capacity needed for the additional vehicles, additional traffic, except for the months of June and July. And we believe that the overflow traffic during those peak travel seasons, travel months, will elect to travel into Alaska through Prince Rupert instead. Marine Highways intends to focus our marketing efforts on Prince Rupert in the near term as well as in the long term. A benefit of moving the Malaspina to Lynn Canal will be to free up the fast ferry Fairweather to provide improved dayboat service to Sitka and Petersburg. And in addition, the service to the Aleutian chain we are proposing to reduce by placing the Kennecott on a 2x2 schedule as a cost-saving measure. And that concludes my my statement. I assume that this will generate questions and comments. Thank you, Chairman Johansson.
I think the questions and comments were generated when the schedule was floated about a month ago.
Representative Ledoux has joined us, and Representative Wilson as well. Thank you. Welcome.
Before we get into the questions, just as an overview for the committee, who or what can you give me your job description? It says Marine Operations. Is that actually the Marine Highway, or are there other components in the state that you oversee as a Marine?
As a Deputy Commissioner, I am answerable to the Commissioner, Commissioner Von Schaben. And I serve only the Marine Highway, Alaska Marine Highway system.
Alaska Marine Highway. And before I continue, I have to recognize my borough mayor, Joe Williams, just came into the room. Welcome, Mayor Williams. You notice a little, I've got one, two, three, four or five constituents in the room today. So I'm under the gun here, everybody. So you all know what's going on.
For some reason, Mr. Chairman, this appears to be a particular interest for people from Southeast Alaska.
Actually, you know, that's one point that I'd like to make. It is particularly interested to my folks in Ketchikan and obviously in Southeast Alaska, but also Prince William Sound and out on the chain. And actually, maybe, Commissioner, you could review the areas that the Marine Highway covers. What are we talking about? Because oftentimes when we talk about the Marine Highway, it's those hyperventilating primates from Southeast. That's directed at me, not you, Representative. But a lot of times when you say Marine Highway, it's automatically those folks down in Southeast chirping. But can you just broadly overview where the Marine Highway serves, I believe, over 33 communities in the state?
Certainly. I believe it's approximately 30 in the state. Prince Rupert and Bellingham are the southern entryways, the Marine Highway system. The mainline route continues up through Southeast to Skagway and to Haines so travelers can go all the way through southeast and into the Canadian, through Canada and into Alaska. We do have a cross Gulf route that goes into Prince William Sound that serves the communities of Valdez, Cordova, and Whittier. And traffic can then proceed on into the interior and into South Central as well. The Gulf route is used extensively by the military to bring military folks in their furnishings and that type of thing into military bases, Eielson, Fort Wainwright, in Fairbanks, and Fort Rich, in Elmendorf, in the Anchorage area. Also Kodiak, Coast Guard. The southwest route includes Kodiak, Homer, Port Lions, and one more, and then continues on down the Aleutians all the way to Unalaska is the end of the Alaska Marine Highway System.
So it's a connected transportation route from Bellingham, Washington, all the way out to Unalaska.
Yes.
Representative Newman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a little bit of a question and a comment there. But you know, although this does really catch the attention of people from southeastern Alaska, it's still part of the Department of Transportation. It's a big part of DOT, and we all have a large part to play in what that, you know, and kind of a question at, and I'm going to ask this on behalf of my friend from Beaver, because I think it's a very good question. Is, you know, and he's talked about maybe the possibility, and I think very feasible myself, a possibility of even a ferry system on a river system throughout central Alaska, particularly on the Yukon there. As director, have you looked at anything like that, or do you anticipate anything of, well, how do you investigate things like that, or the possibilities of something like that?
Well, I understand that Representative Salmon has introduced a bill actually last year to provide marine highway service in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. To my knowledge, that bill has not been passed. We've provided information to the committee on providing a study if the bill is passed and the study is funded. And based on that study, we would make our recommendations. I would like to note that we have not expanded service to other communities yet. We've had requests from two communities this past year that, and we've sent them responses that we really don't have the operating funds to expand the system at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dugan, is it germane to this flow? So I think Representative Salmon had.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah. The question I have is, which two communities has requested that?
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, the two communities are Ozinki and Perryville.
Thank you. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe you said that, was it that your request in the budget this year is $87 million general fund? Is that?
Through the chair to Representative Dugan, the governor's budget is about $89 million in general fund operating costs. There's an additional $12 million of general fund money that will go to minor maintenance and overhaul of the vessels.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in addition to the $89 million general fund, what does the ferry system generate in terms of revenues? Does the ferry system get to keep the money it earns, and if so, how much is that?
Through the chair, Representative Duke, and the Marine Highways revenue is approximately $50 million a year, and I'll request clarification from that on, I'm sorry, $49.3 million. And yes, the revenue is going to a fund that we can operate the system from that fund.
And just one more. So if I was to, if I were to try to figure out what the anticipated budget for the ferry system in the next fiscal year is, if I added up the general fund and the ferry system's revenues, would that be the total for the operation, for operations?
Assuming the operations remain the same as this year, there are variables that enter into our operating budget. And those would include boats that are going into capital improvement projects or layup for major work, and we would have to shift from one boat to another, possibly shifting routes. I believe we use about a 3% inflation factor, and fuel is a great unknown, the escalating price of fuel. We're also in negotiation on three labor contracts that we hope to have those signed this winter as well. So that would increase our operating costs.
And just before we go too far off topic, we have scheduled at least a couple hearings to get into the revenue and the operating and all that sort of issues. So I'd like to try and keep us on track with the schedule at this point. They're all very good questions, but if we could just, as a committee, focus in on the specific topic of the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the point I was trying to get to is that if something slightly more than a third of the revenue for the ferry system is dependent on passengers pay, it seems to me it would behoove the system to try and get as many people in as possible, which would also, it seems to me, behoove the system to publish that schedule as soon as it could. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, the final operating plan that you came up with, is that was the plan meant to fit into a funding box, or did you come up with a plan that you thought would work, and that's the number that came out on the other end?
Representative Johansson, it's really a combination of both of those. We've been challenged to provide a reasonable level of service with fiscal considerations in mind. As I mentioned earlier, the operating cost of the system is escalating. We believe that it's really important to stay under an artificial cap, if you will, of $100 million in operating GF, and that was one of our goals when we put the 08-09 operating plan together.
I guess my question is, were you handed a number from up above and told to make the system work within that number?
No, we were not. We evaluated many scenarios, combinations of vessels on routes, came up with many numbers in developing the budget.
Did you forward different scenarios to the third floor and were handed back a number to make the system work under? Is that accurate?
We did provide the information to the administration, but we were not provided back a number that we would have to live with. We defended our budget to OMB through DOT.
Interesting. Representative Dahl, if I had a question.
Yeah, thank you. You were talking about the cost versus the revenue. Has it always been that kind of percentage? Could you give me a feeling of how that went over, say, a period of 10 years, the last 10 years? Has it always been about half, or could you?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, the I really don't have the history of the funding for the Marine Highway System with me. We can provide that, but you're correct. Right now, for every dollar that we bring in revenue, we do spend approximately $2 in general fund. And that has escalated over the past several years due to costs associated with fuel, labor, and just general expense inflation. But we can provide that if you'd like.
And I also believe it has something to do with the choice of runs and choices that were made by the system throughout those years. So it's not just a matter of, that's what I'm getting at. I'm interested in what that proportion is.
Yes, Representative Dell, you're correct that the cost of the system is based in large part on the boats and the routes that are selected. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I have a series of questions, but most specific to the route questions, and they may need to be answered later, so I'll try to run through them quickly for you. I'm interested in how many passengers were serviced last year versus the changes that you're asking, and how what you anticipate the service to passengers will be in this new proposed schedule. How many people will you move? And then I'm wondering how many vehicles you will move, because as I understand it, when we talk about the Bellingham run, we added an additional ship there, an additional ship that used to be carrying at 100% capacity on vehicles and now carries two of them at 50% capacity. So it looks like we have increased service, but we're not really transporting more vehicles. And so it was more efficient to run one boat full than it is for us to run two boats half full, because we're moving the same product. So I'm interested in knowing the vehicles that are being moved. And then I want to know, are the vehicles where you make your money, or is it the passengers, as Representative Dahl was asking and Representative Dugan was alluding to on revenues? Is the system bringing in money by moving people, or is it bringing in money by moving freight? I think the answer is the vehicles and the freight, but...
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, the Marine Highway System brings in revenue from passengers, from their vehicles, and from freight as well.
When the commissioner spoke to us last year, I believe that what we were given was that there was more money made on the vehicle side than it is on the passenger side. That was a year ago's presentation in a joint hearing with Senate and House.
Excuse me, just please. They're about the same.
In the proposed new schedule?
The income from passengers and vehicles is about the same. And the second part of the question, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, with the new proposed route and the different use of vessels, how do you anticipate the movement of freight, vehicles, and passengers? I assume if you're reducing the schedule that there's going to be a drop, should be anticipated, so you should be able to cost out a future forecast of loss in revenue, which is sort of getting to the previous speaker's questions on, have you anticipated that in the run, so that you're developing a model that's more cost effective if you're going to deter service?
I'm going to have to request a little help on the response to that. Excuse me.
Have that Commissioner, let's. I think the question has been articulated quite well, and again, we'll have David go through the minutes and pick out some of those questions that, just in this, for the sake of time. Did you have more, Representative?
Well, I just would share with the committee. I'm sure that you've received it, but I've had multiple inquiries from residents along our coastal communities that are concerned with the new schedule and how it will affect their lifestyle and their movement of both passengers, vehicles, and freight. And so that concerns me, but my only other question, being from the coastal community's perspective, an interior girl, living in Eagle River, I have access to a road system, so I can access those resources differently. So I may view it differently, and I want to make sure that I'm sensitive and acquire enough information so that I can make good decisions on that. But I'm wondering how many of those coastal communities that we're accessing have other modes of transportation available to them, too. So that's sort of the finality of my questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Newman and then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hardy, I'd like to follow up on the chair's questions on funding requests through the administration from your department. And I know what happens in my district. Now I'm going to have my Matsu Borough Assembly person in my office tomorrow, you know, requesting more money from the state and, you know, trying to make sure that the legislature funds certain, you know, projects within the state. And I'm sure that people in South Central do the same thing with the chair, you know, saying, you know, by golly, legislator, you know, why aren't you funding the marine transportation system to its full extent? And in all fairness to the governor, with the realization that we're going to have less and less money in our budget. And maybe we do need to start ratcheting down, you know, or preparing for days when that does happen. You know, I mean, that is a reality that we're all facing. So are you saying that the requests that you made are what you feel is the full commitment or what it'll take to run this without shortchanging? Or is this a bare bones type of a proposal? Or would you have, if you had suggestions to the legislature where you think it might be helpful to have more funds, are you prepared to answer that? Or because I know the questions that this man to my left, the chair, gets are probably the same ones I do. They're in all of us as committee members, just happen to do with a different road.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, no, this is not a bare bones budget. There could be brutal reductions in service. Service and operating costs are essentially synonymous. We can make changes on vessels and routes, but it is all about funding to provide service. We were requested by three legislators to provide information back to them on what it would cost to avoid putting the Kennecott on a 2x2 schedule for the year. And I have to mention that the Kennecott is one of our most expensive boats to run. It's in the range of $425,000 a week to operate that vessel. This year, the Kennecott is laid up most of the winter for cost-saving reasons.
You save money by parking it.
It is parked, yes. We did, as I mentioned, we did provide some numbers to some three legislators for alternatives to the Kennecott schedule. And we looked at three options. One was to run the Kennecott on a full-time basis year-round, except for a period of time when she is laid up for some maintenance work. And that came out to be about $4.1 million. The second alternative is to run the Kennecott full-time during the Tustamina vessel. Her layup, the Tustamina, serves Southwest. And running the Kennecott the remainder of the year on a 2x2 schedule, that came out about $2.3 million.
If I may, Mr. Chair, that's information I think that we're going to be getting, but I just really would like to, again, make sure we stick to the question. Like what I was asking is, do you feel that you're providing the maximum amount of benefit that you can, and was this the best that you can? Or just to follow up on the chair's question, I'd like a little bit more on that, and just a short answer.
We are not providing full service under the current budget.
And if I maybe if you could expand that and what cost, maybe that would be interesting. I know that I'd like to see that, and I'm sure our chair would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Johnson, I'm going to quirk you with Representative Faircloth. She and Representative Keller need to run off to a HESC committee. I think you had a question before you left.
I just wanted to, it just hit me that we had talked during our discussion about the Ocean Rangers program, that the cruise ship industry may supplant some of the labor force into their hulls as they went through, and we were wondering whether that would draw the labor force because of the Ocean Rangers requirement away from the ferry system, because that's where the most talent to operate those vehicles were at. Does this in any way, has the Ocean Ranger program affected the ability to retain or recruit pilots for our ferry system?
Excuse me, just a second.
I think I can answer that, because the program hasn't really been put together yet, so I don't think timing-wise.
I just wanted to know if that affected the schedule at all.
They just contracted out with a private company, and I don't think the effects have trickled down to the Marine Highway yet. So I think we'll see in the out years how that affects them.
Thank you.
Thank you, too. I know you have to run. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am curious about the decision, and I want to make sure I heard you correctly, to emphasize Prince Rupert in marketing and what went into that decision, and also service and marketing, and maybe I heard you wrong, but what went into the decision to go to Prince Rupert as opposed to Bellingham with service, and were there market studies done? Were there passenger surveys done? Are we getting a better deal to port? Why is it shorter distances? Tell me what played into the decision to go through, I want to say this before our Penwar friends get here, through Canada, in light of the new travel restrictions, in light of the weakening dollar, the costs there. So can you kind of fill me in on the decision process that went into and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, of emphasizing Prince Rupert as opposed to Bellingham?
The decision to select this scenario was based essentially on consensus of Marine Highway Management. We've used ridership figures, revenue figures, the percentage of capacity of the vessels that have been utilized, and on that route it is the Malaspina and the Columbia. And operating cost savings as well. Again, as I mentioned, we did move the Malaspina up into southeast Lynn Canal area, where we believe that the additional service is necessary. As far as marketing studies, I would have to defer that question to my staff.
Hello?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I heard you say that it was done by the Marine Highway Management, that this decision was made based upon a criteria. Is there any way we could see some of that criteria, the difference in I'm an airline guy, so I'm going to call it employment just as a slip. But your difference in passenger loads between the two, what we're looking at. I know Prince Rupert did an awful lot of recruiting, and they were up and down the halls here, and they spent a lot on facilities. And I just want to make sure that we made a sound business decision, as opposed to an emotional decision to help out. I know there was all kinds of talk about different runs between Prince Rupert and other areas in southeast, and I just want to make sure that that I guess I'd like to see some data on that if possible, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure how to go about getting that. I'm never fond of decisions that just, well, we just made it, a group of us got together and made it. That's a fairly substantial decision to make, And once again, in light of the border restrictions that we're facing, may or may not get worse. Who knows what's going to happen with our provable ID, whatever you want to call it, the passport situation, the cost of the dollar, all of those things, you know, play into it. And we're looking at maybe a 10% reduction in the value of the dollar from when this decision was made. And does it still make sense? And are we obligated contractually? A lot of questions, but I'm pretty keen on knowing some of the reasons why that decision was made. Have nothing against Canada. I'd just like to see, you know, why it was made. And if it's a great decision, why don't we move everything there? So just kind of be able to justify that at some point to me. And I'm not sure how the best way to go about it, Mr. Chairman, but I think it was something that I'd certainly like to look into.
I think you understand the gist of the question. You can provide that to my office, and we'll distribute it. And by the way, that's the group right here in the room, basically. Is that right? The management team is basically right here?
Yes.
Then why'd you do it? No, just teasing. Just having some fun.
We're all having fun. That leads into a couple questions that I had about the Prince Rupert run. I'm not going to pretend like I can sit down and write a ferry schedule any better than Captain Falvey or the rest of the gang here. But I guess my first question is this schedule that you've put out, do you anticipate consistency with this schedule? Is this going to be the same schedule for the next 3 years? To quote one of the letters that I got, are we going to reinvent the keel again next year? Because one of the real frustrations is, as I've articulated to you before and to every other Marine director that we've had, is consistency. Are we going to turn around next year and end up moving ships around again? I know a lot of it depends on the conditions of the vessels, but I mean, is this going to be it for a few years? Can we rely on this and have businesses and communities adjust to this and get used to it, or are we going to be going through this whole thing again next year?
Chairman Johansson, we recognize the importance of reliable schedules and not providing the public with a lot of changes every year. So we do propose that this schedule will remain pretty much the same over the next at least 3 years.
And following that logic of taking one of the vessels off the Bellingham Inside Passage run and having folks go through Prince Rupert, I haven't seen any plans for A, improving the Prince Rupert terminal. I know we've talked about it at a meeting that we had in Ketchikan. I believe you two were online. I think you were online as well. And B, the Gateway Shuttle. I haven't seen that anywhere lately. I don't think it's in the 2030 plan that we talked about. I'm wondering if you're going to make a shift, and it's a pretty big shift, from two mainliners going down to Bellingham, and your expectations are people are going to flow up to Prince Rupert. How are those two things being taken care of? What is your plan for the terminal and the connection to Ketchikan?
Chairman Johansson, you are correct. There are some deficiencies with the terminal at Prince Rupert. There have been some repairs made. We do consider the dock to be safe, but it is old and it's deteriorating. And we have entered into discussions with the owners which to repair that. We've sent a letter to them requesting repairs, expressing our concerns with the fees that we're paying to put our vessel in that area. So those are ongoing discussions. The Southern Gateway Shuttle, I believe you're correct that the 2030 plan essentially says we will not be expanding service in that plan. So the Southern Gateway Shuttle is in the SATP, or the, I'm sorry, the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan. But at this point, until we prepare a master plan that tells us where the marine highway system is headed and how we're going to get there, we do not have a vessel replacement plan, and that includes the Southern Gateway Shuttle.
And, of course, the follow-up is, when is your latest master plan being let out so you can start making these decisions?
We have an RSA, Reimbursable Services Agreement, with University of Alaska Transportation Center, and they have a team of consultants that will be working on the master plan. We signed that RSA in December, so we do have a team working on it now. We have two deliverable dates, and those are the first phase, which is essentially an as-built condition or existing conditions, the marine highways, a suite of alternatives to evaluate, and a framework for making recommendations. The deliverable date for that is October 2008. The second phase, we believe, right now it's scheduled for October 2009, so it is a two-year effort.
Okay. Representative Newman.
I've been around my friend to the left, and I can read his mind, and I'm going to ask this question. You got a 30-year or 20-year plan, 2030 plan, and did I just hear you say that nowhere in that 20-year plan, do you have plans to upgrade the ferry system or replacement of any of the vessels there? Or, I mean, where does the ferry system fit into this 20-year plan?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, what I meant to say was that the 2030 plan says there will be no expansion of service. The 2030 plan does recognize the fact that we have an aging fleet and that vessel replacement is required, and that will take a lot of money. We don't know exactly where that money is coming from. As we prepare the master plan, we'll be working, in fact, we are working with the administration, trying to identify revenue sources for vessel replacement. Of 11 vessels, we have four that are in the range of 45 years old, and the life expectancy is about 60 years. So we have four boats that are going to be coming to the point where they need to be replaced soon.
I couldn't agree further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand the way the system works, if it's not in the 2030 plan, it can't be in the STIP, or we can't move money around in the STIP to address this. So what I think I just heard you say is we can almost positively exclude federal money from the ferry system unless we have it in the STIP, have it in the 2030 plan, and it's sort of, it looks to me like we have just kept ourselves from getting federal money, unless I've misunderstood the testimony of the 2030 plan and what the STIP does, and everything has to be. We just heard testimony that it had to be in the STIP before you could make a changes, and how much it costs just to make an amendment to a change. Does that not apply to the ferry system? Or is there a different set of laws for water than roads and airports?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. Mr. Otteson mentioned the SHACWAC funding in particular. SHACWAC funding is in the range of $10 to $25 million annually, and that no longer exists as of 2009. Federal funding is forecasted to level off and possibly be reduced. Those are projections. As far as the STIP interface with the 2030 plan and funding for marine highways, I would have to defer to Mr. Otteson.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recognize the fact that it's leveling off, but I think if I'm understanding it, and I certainly would like to be corrected, is that we are saying that even though they're leveling off, that if they're not in the 2030 plan or the STIP, that no part of the federal money that's in the STIP will be used to the marine highway, so that we're really looking at general funds or some other fund source unidentifiable that you're working with the administration to find. So we're looking at every penny that we spend on the ferry system in the next 20 years being general fund money. And maybe I've just totally got my hands wrapped around this wrong, but I certainly would like some clarification.
Let's what we're going to do is
unless
hold
you
off
want to, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think what we can do for the purpose of this meeting is hold off on that thread of questioning until Mr. Otteson comes back on Thursday or Tuesday, and we can delve into that more. But Dave's over there frantically writing down the questions, so if you don't know, you don't know, and we'll ask Jeff when he comes up. Representative Dugan and then Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to the schedule, but the operating plan, I guess, is what we actually got in front of us. And I just realized that I'm not exactly sure what it is you're telling me here. So during the summer, Columbia will be sailing from Bellingham. It's the only ferry that will be sailing from Bellingham. And it will be sailing something called the Bellingham Friday route. Does that mean it's only sailing once a week from Bellingham north?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, could I defer that just for a second?
Yes,
Chuck. Yes, it is once a week, and since Chuck Van Kirk has produced the schedules, and if you have additional questions, it might be more efficient for us to just. I'd like to defer those to him.
Sure. I don't care who answers them as long as I can get an answer. So we have one sailing a week from Bellingham, and it's the Columbia, which you say will be sufficient for the traffic except in the months of June and July, I believe was the statement. Is that correct? Okay. In the meantime, we have this Taku that's sailing from Prince Rupert to Juneau twice a week. And the Matanuska, are these two sailings? Matanuska from Prince Rupert to Skagway and then from Prince Rupert to Juneau? Are those two separate sailings?
That's correct.
So, before we go on, do we want to get into the minutia of the schedule?
I'm getting to someplace here.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I understand.
I just don't want folks answering from the audience out there. And
no.
I think the director of the Marine Highway is more than capable of taking care of his own business. So go ahead and throw it out there.
As I said, Mr. Chairman, I don't care who answers these questions as long as I can get an answer. So we've got essentially at the height of the tourist season or during the entire tourist season, what we're doing is we're pushing for folks north to Prince Rupert. Do we have any idea whether they're actually going to go north to Prince Rupert and get on the ferries? Do we have any information? Does the department have any information at all that will reassure me that moving people off to Bellingham north route to a Prince Rupert north route is going to work?
Through the chair to Representative Dugan, we as I mentioned earlier, we will be providing marketing emphasis on Prince Rupert. That may include incentives fare reductions or other incentives. So we do believe that we can convince the overflow traffic from Bellingham into Prince Rupert. Yes, we do.
I believe that's a build it and they will come strategy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That wasn't exactly the question I asked. But I guess what I want to ask is this question. Did you make the decision to move the Salines to Prince Rupert and then decide that you could sell it? Or, I mean, was it an operational decision that now it becomes a question of whether it's a commercially viable decision? Or I think what I'm hearing is you really don't have any idea whether people are going to do this because you don't have any information to support the theory that they're going to drive that extra whatever it is to the fine city of Prince Rupert to get on the ferry. Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, I think it's more than just whether we have an idea or don't have an idea. We do believe that we can provide incentives to convince the traffic, the overflow traffic, to go the Prince Rupert route. And that's the best I can say at this point. The ridership will decide that question.
I believe, Representative Dugan, that the key points is that they believe that they can convince, is what I heard. And if I hear you correctly, that I guess we'll find out from Representative Johnson's request of the data that drove this decision. But from what I'm getting is we'll see.
Mr. Chairman, that's just not particularly reassuring, even either on the face of it for this time or for what the Deputy Commissioner said earlier about trying to provide the same schedule for the next 3 years. What happens if this doesn't work?
And then very quickly, before I go to Representative Dahl, and just a very quick answer, is that the same? Did you go through the same motions to decide to cut the Kennecott to 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off? Was it the same conversation in the same room with the same folks with the same set of database or lack of database?
Chairman Johansson, it was run through the entire management team, yes.
Thank you. Representative Dahl has been very patient. I'm sorry. I missed you.
Well, I appreciate being part of this committee for this short time, so I thank you very much. I'm just going back to some figures that I have on the Prince Rupert, and I can see that from the calendar year of 2005 to 2007, the embarking traffic has actually gone down from 4,256 to 3,516, and yet the embarking traffic in Bellingham went up. From 5,867 to 6,057. So I'm just trying to figure out how the numbers work here, that for the rationale of moving something to Prince Rupert. And of course, I also know that the Bellingham route is the docking facilities are excellent, and the pier facilities are excellent, and versus something that's going to need improvement. Going back to the idea of the Kennecott, I have a question. Does it cost money? What is having it lay up for 2 weeks and then come on? I mean, you have personnel, of course, that are not being employed, I presume, during that time. But is there also any kind of operating problems with having motors and everything shut down for a period of a couple of weeks and then brought back up again? Could you, I know I have two things going on here about with the Prince Rupert and that, but I wonder if you could just sort of address both of them some kind of.
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, as I understand the first part of the question dealt with ridership statistics, and the second part of the question deals with the operational aspects of going to a two-on-two-off schedule.
I
I'd like to respond. We will provide you the information regarding the ridership discussion that you've presented. As far as the operational considerations of laying up vessels, Chairman Johansson, can I defer that part of the question to Captain Falvey?
What I'd like you to do is, if you would provide us the cost of laying up the Kennecott for 2 weeks, what does it cost to put her shoreside, tie her up, keep it warm, etc.? What does it cost to park it, basically, I guess, is my question. Representative Salmon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a general statement rather than a question. It seems like when I first came down here about, I think, 3 sessions ago, I was kind of a little against the ferry system, but after dealing with the ferry system in transportation, which I've been on for, this is my 4th session, seemed like it's a very good idea. I do support it 100%. And but what I gather each time in the Transportation Committee is that it seemed like every year there's a big fight about getting money for the ferry system. And as we go along, we see how our state budget is increasing. I mean, we're having more income from, hopefully, the oil. And from the picture that you painted today, you're talking about the aging fleet, you're talking about the money, appropriations, and the budget issues, reduced schedules, passengers, ridership, freight. And, of course, there was questions from the representatives here that, you know, the question from the administration and is this a politics that we have to play every year? I mean, when we have a lot of money, this shouldn't be an issue, seems like, you know. We have a lot of people, I think, in the House of Representatives and on the other side that they will support this program. I mean, they have people in the area that they could support this program. I mean, seems to me, I couldn't get my finger on any one of this. Why are we going down, you know? I mean, is there an up picture for this program? I mean, there must be somewhere. I mean, what would it be? More money? I mean, could you answer the future? I mean, they brought the future, the 2030-year plan. I mean, why do we have to go through this every year? Why can't we say, well, we just need more money to do this, and, you know, we'll fix that problem? I mean, seems to me that we're something's not right here. Seems like, I mean, every year it's a problem. We have to fight just to keep this program going. We know how much it costs to keep it going. If we need more money, I'm sure we can put a little more money into it. And seems like, I don't want to say this, administration wants to put it down. But I mean, why can't we just lift it up a little and just keep it going? Because the Southeast needs it, you know? A lot of people like Angoon doesn't even have an airport. And all the float planes are not, they barely operate in the wintertime. I mean, it caused hardship throughout the Southeast if you could see the terrain or the geography. But I just don't get the answer. That's what my problem is. I mean, I can't pinpoint on where of all these problems that you indicated that if there is a problem. I mean, if there's a problem, then we should apply a little money to it. That's what I'm saying. And where could that be?
Representative Salmon, I feel like what you just said. I mean, I'm so frustrated, just like you are. Every single year, we fight to keep this system afloat, you know, and it gets old after a while. And I mentioned that earlier, you know, when we talk about the Marine Highway, it's about southeast a lot. But it reaches all throughout the state, not only where the ships tie up, but how it feeds people up into the interior. We had the McDowell report from a few months ago that showed how many people who get on in Bellingham end up in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. We've got reports. I got an email the other day about the increase in troops that are going to be 4,500 over the next 5 years that are going up to, and you mentioned it yourself, Fort Rich and Wainwright, et cetera. You know, that cross-Gulf ship, you know, that's how most of those folks go. You know, what we want to do is get people into the system, feed them up through southeast. We want to send them up to these districts up here in the summertime, people who want to come and see Alaska. In the wintertime, we need good, stable movement of goods and services from Bellingham all the way out to the chain. And I understand that there's a lot of problems and a lot of challenges with funding. And I told you when I spoke to you earlier, you know, I don't care what it costs. It's up to us to appropriate the money. You know, you guys need to make a system that works. And maybe this is it. I don't know. Like I said, I'm no expert. This may be the grandest plan of all time, and everything is going to fall into place perfectly. But I can identify a few things. When you're going to start moving people up through Prince Rupert, logically, you would want to think out the next few years in Prince Rupert. You've got a terminal down there that's a mess, and it's been there for a long time. We all recognize that. But I don't see any plan to fix it. We've got the Taku going back and forth. Yet I don't see any proactive plan to stick a replacement in the 2030 plan or put it in the STIP. We've been talking about this Gateway Shuttle for quite a few years now. I guess my frustration, and Representative Salmon got me fired up because he's speaking, you know, from the heart. And I don't see you guys out there being proactive. You know, we see the presentations at Southeast Conference, and it's nothing but doom and gloom. And I think he's asking, what's the upside? Where's the proactive effort by the department to say, hey, this is what we need to do it? You know, from my perspective, you get a number from up high. Maybe that's not how it happened, but that's how it was explained to me in the past. And, you know, it seems like we sit here every single year and we're the ones fighting for it. And I know the guys on the ground back there, you know, care about this system. I'm sure you do. But it's tough every single year. It'd be nice to fight with you rather than against you once in a while. Anybody else? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I kind of did this exercise in a meeting with fisheries, and there were always problems, and it was always crisis management. And so what I asked the department to do was come back with a plan that will solve the problem, that will provide the service, that will optimize the equipment, that will allow you to do your maintenance, and then let the legislature make a decision on whether or not that's the money we want to invest or what portion of the money we want to invest. But it never seems like we get the opportunity to do that. We always get brought a piecemeal budget, a crisis management budget. It's not just your department, so I'm going to take a little heat off of you. Every department comes to us with how we're going to manage this, how we're going to fix this problem. And today especially, in the very near future, we're not going to have the opportunities we have this year and next year. If we can put things in place that will take us 10, 15 years down the road now, but we don't have that opportunity as a legislature. We continue to see budgets that managed by crisis, and in the case of game management and fish management, if there's a closing, if the fish aren't there, we close it. We don't go out and get the data we need to really make a sound decision. So I've charged them with going out and finding out what it would take to get the information to make decisions based upon information, not crisis. So I think what I'd like to do is challenge you with the same thing. What would it cost to provide service, to utilize the equipment, to not lay it up, to maximize the routes, do your magic with your ridership and your freight, and what would it cost us to come up with that plan and to fund that plan? And then that's a decision the legislature can make. We can say, it's too much. Yeah, we can handle it. Or no, we need to go back to Plan B. But we don't have that option right now. The only option we have right now is the one that's before us. And I don't see that as being a terribly good option. It doesn't plan for the future. It kind of leaves us in the same old circular logic that we've always had. And a representative told me who did this, and I don't know who it was, but I will learn who made this quote. But to the definition of insanity is to do the same things over and over again and expect different results. And it looks to me like we're doing the same things over and over and over again. We're not getting different results. And I'm beginning to wonder if there's not some insanity going on. So I'd just like to challenge you to come up with a plan that's optimal for service, optimal for utilization of equipment, and see if we can fund it or what portion of it we can fund. But we don't have that option now, and we've not been given that option in any department budget for a long, long time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I could have said that better myself.
I doubt that. Johnson.
But I think there's one more element to this. If I'm not mistaken, when the commissioner was here last year, it was the deputy commissioner. I can't remember exactly, but he testified that essentially what you have is a Southeast transportation plan that attempts to turn the ferry system into a thing that hops over water. Basically, you build roads every place now, and instead of sailing up the inside passage, in theory, you drive up the inside passage, and when you hit some barrier that you just can't get around, you pop yourself onto a little ferry and shoot across and start all over again. I was just sitting here wondering if that's because it's easier to get road funding than it is ferry funding from the federal government, that this appears to be the alternative that's the choice of the Department of Transportation, because, quite frankly, I don't like their chances for building and maintaining a road that runs up this coast, you know, and nobody's been able to convince me since that was originally proposed that they're very good. If the problem is that boats are, we're going to have to pay for boats, but we can get Uncle Sam to pay for roads, right? Then somebody should say that, and we should be able to make a decision on whether we want to pay for the boats or not. And we may be forced, you know, just by the finances of the thing, but at least we will have had a chance to make this decision. The thing that bothers me about all of this is that what drives our decision is what a bunch of planners in Washington, D.C. think that we have to do now to be able to do what we want to do in the future. And because of the way, you know, who knows, in this 1,700-page amendment, there's probably a lot of things, but because of the way the money is allocated in the rest of the country, we're stuck with limited options, including ones that, in my view anyway, won't really work down, you know, down in this area or in a lot of Alaska. So I just want to say that we should have an opportunity to make these decisions ourselves. That's what we're here for. And that it would help if instead of getting either the plan that satisfies the Washington bureaucrats or the plan that just doesn't torque the governor's budget too much, if we could get from someplace a plan that we could look at that would give us sort of a realistic idea of how to fix this problem. And then we could decide whether or not we wanted to pay for it or if we had the money to pay for it or whatever the case might be. But we're never really going to get anywhere as long as our discussions are limited to what we can squeeze into a 30-year plan and then into a one-year plan that you can't amend, you know, or if they're, you know, simply this is the kind of Band-Aid I want to slap on this system this year.
Thank you.
So you said it better.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't need an answer unless you can do it quickly today. But in the Matanuska Valley, you know, we're going to have a ferry that goes from Point McKenzie to hopefully Anchorage if Mayor Begich lets us get a place to dock a ferry there in the very near future. Is that part of the Alaska's ferry system plan overall, or is that included anywhere in that?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, no, it is not in the Marine Highways plan.
It's private.
Yep, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? As I said, we'll bring the Marine Highway back and get a little deeper into operations and capital expenditures, etc. Otherwise, thank you all for attending, and thanks to the committee. We're adjourned for the day.